This morning's meditation is titled The New Eve and the Resurrection. You recall that kind of the overarching theme of the spiritual exercises has been Daughters of Eve, right? I think I may have just stolen that line from Chronicles of Narnia. When the kids came out of the closet and they first encountered the White Witch, and she called them, you know, Son of Adam and Daughter of Eve or something like that.
Yes.
So there you go. In that positive, cheery context, that's all of you. But there is a reason for that, because Adam and Eve were the original man and woman, and that was God's original blueprint for humanity. And through the fall, God is constantly adapting. I'm recording, so I'll avoid heresies here, but God is constantly adapting himself. He doesn't change, but he adapts himself to different circumstances perpetually. And after the original plan kind of fell through, which was a perfect Adam and Eve and a perfect humanity and giving a perfect yes to God in the moment of trial, and we all live happily ever after, he immediately promises that there will be, he doesn't put it in so many words, but a new Adam and a new Eve. Especially in the passage in Genesis 3 when he says, he will crush the head of the serpent with his heel. Interestingly enough, I forget which is which, if it's Hebrew or Greek, but one of the languages has he will crush your head and the other one has she will crush your head. Which, in light of, it's not an accident in light of, in God's plan. Because, as we said in the beginning, humanity, when God made us, Adam was incomplete until there was an Eve. And in the creation of Eve and in the union between Adam and Eve, then humanity became complete. He never conceived of Adam or Eve as just being isolated beings. Part of that being made in the image and likeness of God implies that we are made for relationship, and therefore we're made in relationship, and it's only in relationship that we are complete and that we are perfected. So, for there to be redemption, sure, Christ is the one who brought about redemption, but he chose redemption to come about him as the new Adam with the new Eve. He chose to have his Blessed Mother be part of his plan of redemption. And that has real repercussions for us, because the Blessed Virgin Mary, aside from being this wonderful mother and representative of humanity and advocate, she is also the icon of the Church. And that's something that I think we always need to keep in mind. There's a statement somewhere in one of the, I don't remember which council, but that whatever is said of the Blessed Virgin Mary can be said of the Church and vice versa. So the Blessed Virgin Mary, is she a mother, Virgin Mother? Yes. So is the Church. The Church is immaculate, although she has children that are, you know, individual members of the Church are not so immaculate. But the Church, in as much as the Church, is immaculate, and the Church gives birth to new children all the time through grace. Is the Church, whatever you want to say about the Church, you can say about the Blessed Virgin Mary and vice versa. Because she is the icon, she is the highest, most exalted member of the Church, short of the head, who is Christ himself, but she is also the image of everything that the Church is meant to be and everything that the Church is meant to become. So if you want to see the Church in its best, you look at the picture of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and there you will see it. So why am I going into all of this? Well, we have a meditation this morning on the new Eve and the resurrection. Now, as we know, there is no place in the Bible where it talks about Jesus meeting his mother. St. Ignatius, when he adds this meditation, his own version of the meditation, and he just says, look, the Bible presupposes that we have common sense. So, of course, Jesus went to see her first. That's as far as his argument goes. And that leaves a lot of space for our own imagination to take place. The closest that we have would be Jesus meeting the other Mary, Mary Magdalene. So we're going to kind of begin with that text. of Jesus' encounter with Mary Magdalene, and then make some applications. First of all, for this text to make sense, I think it's always good, again, to put ourselves in the context. Who was Mary Magdalene? First of all, there's a little bit of question, a little bit of confusion over the generations, because there's so many Marys that pop up, and some of them were associated with sinful women and whatnot, and some of them did the same things. For example, Mary of Bethany, sister of Lazarus and Martha, was she Mary of Magdalene? Probably not. She might have been, but probably not. If she was, then that means they picked up and they moved to a completely different part of Israel and established their shop. It seems very likely that she was not the same, but she did something similar. She washed Jesus' feet with her hair and did those similar kind of gestures. So you're like, well, there's a kindred spirit in many regards. What we do know about Mary Magdalene is she had had seven devils cast out of her. Now, was that literally she was a demoniac possessed, or was it just simply that there were seven deadly vices, you know? Probably both. I mean, this is just me speaking, but I don't see any reason why we should not believe that she was a demoniac and that she had seven demons in her. And that would explain, if you are somebody who is a demoniac, there is really, I think, no greater torture that a person can go through. Did any of you see the movie Nefarious? Yeah. It's worth watching. Nefarious. Don't watch it at nighttime. It was really well done. It's not just a horror movie or spooky, one of these exorcism movies. It was done by Catholics in close consultation with priests who are exorcists and whatnot, and they really nailed it. And we even asked Father Tan, who's a legionary, who's an exorcist, and he said, oh yeah, that's quite good. It's about a guy on death row who is possessed, and his whole interplay with this atheist psychologist who has to give him his evaluation to say, are you crazy? In which case we can't give you the electric chair. Or he didn't want to admit, are you possessed, but are you crazy or not? And the demoniac, the demon, whose name is the Nefarious One, or just AKA Nefarious, that's his name, is going to great lengths to prove to this guy, I'm not crazy, I'm possessed. I am, because he wants to take this man to hell. And he also has a mission that he has planned out for the psychologist, and that's part of the whole drama of the movie. But it really does a good job entering into demonic logic and whatnot. And one of the things is there's really probably no greater torture a person can go through, and there's certainly nothing more humiliating than to be possessed. I mean, you talk about slavery being humiliating. Well, I mean, possession is not even just that like another human being owns you. It's somebody controls your body and somebody who hates you and only wants to degrade and bring you down, to torment you in every way possible, and to bring you to hell as a complete human failure and disaster. That's what a demon wants to do. And frequently, you know, it's a process. How does one even get to the stage of being possessed by the devil? Usually, except for very rare exceptions, people have been doing things they shouldn't be doing, like committing lots of mortal sins and possibly playing with the occult and doing some other things. And demons, generally, once there's one in there, then they start inviting in all their pals. So it's not unlikely that Mary Magdalene was possessed by seven demons. What an abysmal lifestyle that is. Was she a prostitute? Possibly. We don't know that for sure. If she was possessed by seven demons, it's quite possible she was a prostitute. It could go either way. If you're a prostitute living that lifestyle, you're living in a state of grave sin, you could very easily open up the door to seven demons, or vice versa. If you're already possessed, they would love to get you into some lovely industry like prostitution and be a drug addict while you're at it if they can. And anything that they can do that breaks you, that digs you deeper into sin and puts heavier chains on you and makes it more difficult for you to get out of that kind of bondage they will do. Was she the woman caught in adultery, like in Mel Gibson's movie? We have no reason to think that, except for the fact that, again, the woman caught in adultery, who Jesus pardoned under those circumstances, would have been somebody who was radically, radically grateful to Christ and would have really looked upon him with the eyes of, this is the only person who looked and saw me not as a sinner or as an object of lust or as a, you know, something to be thrown away, but this is the only person out there who saw me for who I am, as a daughter of God. So it could have been her, and it's kind of a fanciful depiction on Mel Gibson's part, but why not? Maybe. We know that getting close to Jesus' passion, shortly before the passion, Judas had already, you know, converted in the other direction, joined the dark side, to use the Star Wars analogy. Judas was already going in a bad direction. That shortly before Jesus was crucified, she came in and broke a flask of extremely expensive perfume and anointed Jesus' feet with it and wept, which is not something you do unless you're probably feeling very grateful and very repentant, kind of simultaneously recognizing, man, I was in a bad place and you have transformed my life. So what can we say about a Mary Magdalene? And the reason I'm going into this, even though she's not the Blessed Mother, is I think there are some analogies we can make. Well, she was a person who, whatever her sinful state was deeply, deeply wounded. And somewhere along the line, Christ came into her life and not only revealed her dignity to herself, but also revealed her dignity to the rest of the world and freed her and showed her that she was loved and that she was lovable, gave her this total radical transformation of heart so that she could go and she would become a great saint. He's the first person possibly who looked upon her with purity, with love, and enabled her to kind of rediscover her own dignity. And the interesting thing that happens in this transformation is the more that she's able to discover her own dignity and recognize her own beauty and value and worth, the less, in a certain sense, she becomes the center of her own attention. It's kind of an interesting thing. You'd think that the worse you think about yourself, the less you would want to be looking at yourself and the more you would be looking at somebody else. And that's not the way it works. The more comfortable she was in her skin, the more free she was to love with abandon. And Christ became everything, absolutely everything in her heart and in her life. Her life was inconceivable without him. And he became truly the absolute and radical center of her life. And you see in this gospel passage, I'm not going to dwell on the passage at length, you can use the text, but she's outside the tomb weeping. We talked about the theological virtues. She doesn't have theological faith, but she has great theological love, or hope, charity. She doesn't believe, she doesn't understand. Not like she disbelieves or doubts, she just doesn't understand that there's a resurrection coming around the corner, and actually it just happened. She's outside the tomb weeping. First of all, the very fact that she's there, what's she even doing there? 3 days later, the period at which you were obliged to do something like anoint a dead body was already passed. If the body had gotten to that stage, it's like, okay, you missed it. So she was only there out of love. There was no obligation for her to be there at that stage. And she went there at the second, as early as she possibly could. You know, the minute the sun rose, just the first little glimpse over the horizon, okay, the Sabbath is now over, I can be at the tomb. So immediately she's there. It's like she was, imagine, she didn't even have an alarm clock. I can't even get out of bed I have to sleep in for an hour. She probably never slept anyway. She was probably just sitting there ready to go with her bags and, okay, the sun's up. Boom. That's it. And she was there. And she discovers to her horror, you know, this nightmare is continuing. The tomb is open. He is missing. She encounters the angels. It was interesting. You'd kind of think if you encounter an angel, something would clue you in. It's like, what kind of psychological state was she in? Nobody, even if they looked like human beings and they weren't radiating light or something, although the other gospel says they looked like lightning and the Roman guards fell paralyzed, and none of that seemed to register to her. She's just like, you're not the one I'm interested in, therefore, whatever. Woman, why? Okay, I skipped that whole part. They said to her, woman, why are you weeping? They've taken my Lord, and I don't know where they laid him, as if they know exactly what she's talking about. But when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus there, but did not know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her again, woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for? So Jesus is kind of sticking his finger right into that wound so that she can present it to him and he can heal it. She thought he was the gardener. Interesting, this is a side note, but most of the time in resurrection passages, people don't know who Jesus is, or he looks different. Seemingly, the resurrected Christ, there's something about him that you can only see him with eyes of faith. There's even one of the passages in John 21 later on when he appears to the disciples at the seashore and does the miraculous catch again. And he says, hey, you know, throw the nets over the right side, and they realize, oh, this must be Jesus. But it says, interestingly enough, it says they get to the seashore and he's talking to them and they already know it's him, but they said nobody dared to ask who he was because they knew it was him. They're like, if I'm looking at you, so clearly there's something about it that the physical eyes were no longer able to identify the resurrected Christ for who he is. It's only through faith. So there's something going on here that's like that. Or maybe she was crying so much that she was just she just saw shapes, colors. So, sir, if you carried him away, tell me where you laid him and I will take him. Jesus said to her, Mary. And in that moment, she recognizes. He calls her by name. And Christ does the same thing. None of you would be here on this retreat unless he looked at you and called you by name and invited you to be here. And at that moment, kind of like St. Paul, the scales fall from her eyes and she falls to his feet, you know, and ongoing with the discourse. So what is the point of this? Mary Magdalene discovering, having arrived to a point where Christ was the absolute center of her life, and absolutely nothing made sense without him. And all of a sudden, this nightmare takes place where she sees him instead of so many times before he was able to just defend himself, defeat people's arguments, walk through the crowd. They wanted to kill him, but somehow he would just walk through and nobody could touch him. And all of a sudden, this time, everything goes wrong. And he just seems to be putting up with it. And she witnesses the horror of the crucifixion. And he dies, and then she goes to the tomb, and even then the nightmare is continuing. And under that state of mind, all of a sudden, completely unexpectedly, again, to quote the title of a C.S. Lewis book, she is surprised by joy. And she encounters that all of it has been fixed. That Christ has triumphed even over all of that. I think Mary of Magdala, I walked you through this journey with her because she had a totally different path than the Blessed Virgin Mary. Mary of Magdala, having gone through all of that, arrived to something similar but still lower than where Mary, the mother of Jesus, began her journey years ago. That absolute God, You are absolutely everything, and I just can't even fathom my life without you in the center of it. And just Mary Magdalene was still only approaching something similar. She still wasn't conceived without sin, for starters, but the frame of mind and the spiritual place that the Blessed Mother was as a little girl. And the Blessed Mother has continued this journey and grown and deepened every single day of her life. She was so far ahead of this place. I mean, already where Mary Magdalene is an incredible place, the place of great saints. And that's why I kind of chose to break it open a little bit, to put ourselves in that place. And the Blessed Mother was so far beyond that. So, it reminds me of a quote from St. Teresa of the Child Jesus, when she was saying there was a mentality that the greatest saints are the greatest converts, the ones, which sometimes is true, but, you know, in order to become a really great saint, you have to do like the Mary Magdalene thing and go through that conversion of, you know, from a life of sin and have Christ totally remake you. And like I said, a lot of times that's true. Mary Magdalene, St. Paul, for example, some of these great, great figures that you read in the Bible. But St. Therese said people who say that don't get it at all. Says a person, they pass through the experience, and so therefore they truly do have a deeper appreciation than your run-of-the-mill Catholic does. But what about a person who understands from the beginning that God has not only picked them up from their fall, but even more, he prevented them from falling in the first place? They were completely aware of it. You know, she gives the analogy of a little girl who's going to run and fall. And I said, but what if she discovered that, you know, this wonderful person was watching her ahead of time and made sure that all the circumstances were there, because otherwise she would have fallen. If she didn't, wouldn't you love him even more? Well, that's the Blessed Mother. She was completely aware of, look, without God, I'm just like anybody else, right? And God, if I live in this state that I live in, if I have this degree of love that I have, it is all God. It wouldn't have even occurred to her. It wouldn't have even been conceivable to her to think that somehow she did it. I mean, she knew that obviously she had to continually choose and cooperate. But again, it's very similar to being a priest in that regard. I'm doing this healing ministry with the Encounter Ministries, where I'm taking classes and kind of learning about it. And one of the temptations that apparently can arise for people when you're praying, because you have no idea, it's not like you're feeling supercharged or anything, you're saying prayers and it kind of say, well, hopefully it works. one of the temptations that people can have that I just simply don't really have, this sounds funny, is the feeling I'm not worthy. For me, I never feel unworthy. No, but for me, when you're a priest, you're so used to the fact that you're doing things. The idea, when I celebrate Mass every single day or hear your confessions or do any of those things that only a priest can do, it is so far removed from your thought that this has to do with my worthiness. It's not even in your bandwidth. So I can have other temptations, but the one that I'm not worthy, God couldn't use me, it doesn't even occur to me. If God wants to use me to heal somebody, it's not... doesn't even enter into the conversation, because I'm just used to doing things that are not about me. And I think the Blessed Mother, that's where she was in her relationship with God. So let's go into the heart of the Blessed Mother then. And this is where I would just invite us really to enter into your own contemplation. I will share with you a little bit, kind of one of my own prayers. I don't even know how to do it, because this is one of those imaginative, put yourself in the scene prayers. But this is the way that I frequently will kind of think of Easter morning when Christ comes to see the Blessed Mother. She would have been, first of all, Jerusalem was not that big a place, but she would have been relatively close to where Jesus was crucified. I'm sure, I don't know if she was in the city or out of the city. I tend to think of her, already Jesus was crucified outside the city walls, although in reality, if you've been there and you realize what the configuration of the city was, it was like, if that doorway is the gate to the city, he would have been crucified like where I am, so it's really very close. It's not like they brought him out in just the wilderness or something. But I tend to imagine her, maybe out in the garden somewhere, some place where she could be alone. And so just picture the Blessed Mother, really from the moment of the crucifixion, the burial, alone. The disciples are where they are. Perhaps a Mary Magdalene or somebody wanted to be with her. But seemingly not by the moment of of this gospel passage. Seemingly, Mary Magdala and so a couple of the other women in the other passages show up, but the Blessed Virgin Mary is nowhere to be seen in any of these gospel passages. Now, did she know about the resurrection? Was she awaiting it? Did she understand it? It seems to me that she would have to. If Christ was so explicit with his 12 so many times, saying the Son of Man is going to be crucified and suffer and be risen on the third day, and he lived with her for 33 years, well, 30 years, and then somewhat on the road, how could she not have known? And furthermore, with the intuitive infused knowledge of everything that about God and her son, how could she not have known? But nonetheless, why would she have been in such, a desolate spiritual state then? Well, again, when we think of Mary as the new Eve, right? If Adam and Eve complete humanity, and for example, for the fall to be complete, both Adam and Eve had to fall. For the redemption to kind of be complete, Christ wanted his mother, the new Eve, to be involved. In the Passion, the new Eve was also intimately involved. And everything really that went through Christ's heart, she experienced. She was part of it, and she wanted to be. This was going back to St. Ignatius's third stage of humility, right? It's not like she wanted to be, tortured and, brought to the depths of sorrow in a vacuum, but the idea is whatever her son was experiencing, whatever his desires were, whatever his plans were, whatever God is doing, she wants to be a part of. If he's in rejoicing, she wants to be rejoicing. If she is suffering, she wants to be suffering with him to the exact same extent, although frankly, that was beyond her. But as close as she can, she wanted to be exactly in in unison with everything that had to do with her son. So at the moment of the crucifixion, everything he was going through in her own way, her own feminine and motherly way, she was going through that as well. And in a certain sense, what she may not have been able to experience with the same intensity of Christ, for starters, the whole physical aspect. I mean, maybe Christ mystically allowed her to experience some of the physical, the nails and the scourging and whatnot, but we don't know. And Christ, whatever she went through spiritually, I'm sure Christ went through more just for the simple fact that he is Christ. But having said all that, whatever she may not have been able to suffer exactly the same degree as her son in terms of intensity, she did have a more protracted suffering in the sense that Christ, when he died, it was done. He went to hell, but not as a punishment. He went to bring the good news, so to speak, to Adam and Eve, and to speak to those who are waiting. But he was no longer suffering. He was no longer in torment. She was. Even though she knew that there was a resurrection coming, she still had a very long, from Good Friday afternoon all the way until Christ appeared to her, however many hours that is. Over, it was probably 36 hours, whatever it is. And in my own contemplation, I picture her there, sorrowing, knowing that there's going to come a resurrection, but nonetheless in that place of solitude, somewhere close by, probably periodically going to the place of the crucifixion when nobody's around and just praying there and contemplating everything. Probably she had some little place to stay, somebody, Christ, seemingly they had a lot of friends around the area, so maybe there's probably somebody who had a house somewhere. I don't know where she stayed when she was in Jerusalem, but she must have stayed somewhere because she was around, and it wasn't in the upper room with the 12, for example, during some of those critical moments. So she must have had something, some place. And I always picture her just being there in solitude and in the depths of this anguish, and then almost the way that the sun rises, something very gentle and very small, this indescribable consolation begins in her heart, kind of like watching and not even understanding or knowing what's going on, but just suddenly something starts to change, and it's as if spiritually the sun is rising within her heart, and she starts to feel a joy that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And at that moment, she would have heard the voice of her son behind her. And you can picture it however you want. But very similar to this passage with Mary of Magdala. What would he have said? Would he have said, woman? He seemed to call her that in public. Would he have said, mother? Would he have called her Mary? I don't know. And she, unlike Mary of Magdala, would have been able to embrace him, because she was part of his entire mystery. She wasn't only on the receiving end like Mary of Magdala. She had already received from her conception, she had already received the fruits of the redemption and all those things in an anticipated way. And just freely to contemplate, maybe without even any words, just the embrace and just the self-knowledge, or the mutual knowledge of one another as they look in each other's eyes, and just simply being with each other, and her being filled with the joy of the resurrection. And like Mary Magdala, the joy of the resurrection wasn't so much, it had nothing really to do with herself. It was that the one that she loved was absolutely triumphant. And you know, the worse the suffering that he went through, the more joyful and beautiful would have been the knowledge that here he is, and he's absolutely radiant, and he is glorious, and he's beautiful to behold. And as the new Eve, her joy is the joy of the church. And this is where you and I come in. Because as the new Eve, icon of the church, she is also our model and our icon. And you as women in particular, your model and your icon.